Chapter 7. Topolsky's photographic equipment had not seen the light of day at any prior point on the voyage. It came out onto the deck in straw-packed crates, which Topolsky set about opening and rummaging through. There were contraptions that needed to be unfolded. Others then needed to be screwed together or disassembled and reassembled in some different fashion than they had been put into the crates. Topolsky approached the task with confidence. Before very long, he stood frowning and squinting at the center of a small explosion of pieces, none of which seemed to belong to each other. That was when Dupin intervened and wordlessly and efficiently imposed order on the chaos, with Topolsky standing in a sort of squatting, muttering dejection with his hands on his hips.
"Yes, Monsieur Dupin, that piece there indeed," he would declare at intervals, when it was plain to all observers that Dupin already knew exactly what to do and needed no guidance or encouragement in the matter.
But by turns the equipment took shape, and Topolsky entertained himself by exposing some plates of the surrounding rock slopes and the deck of Demeter. The ship's continued cautious progress was bringing us around the headland, affording an ever-extending view down the length of the lagoon. Part of me remained fully sceptical about the stony projection, but as we caught sight of more and more of the surrounding terrain, so it began to seem still more improbable that there could be any mass of rock large enough to have loomed over the headland from our then vantage point. The average height of the terrain was falling rather than rising, with the eastern end of the lagoon being flanked by much lower and gentler slopes than the rock walls which fringed the western inlet. Topolsky sent Ramos away to make sure that the relevant parties were gathered on deck in anticipation of our first direct sighting of the edifice.
"Dear Dr. Code,"
Countess Cassile greeted me as she arrived, wearing a yellow coat, yellow gloves, and an extravagantly feathered yellow bonnet.
"You have partaken, I suppose?"
"Partaken?" Her eyes seemed to drift to my forearm.
"Breakfasted, I mean. You were not with us at the main table. Or did you think I was referring to something else?"
Beneath the brim of her hat, her expression turned reproving.
"It is not a habit one should cultivate."
"What isn't?"
"Breakfasting alone. Whatever did you think I meant?"
She lifted her gaze from my arm, turning her beam-like attention instead to my face.
"Or were you taking the opportunity to forge ahead with your narrative? One must admire such doggedness in the face of insurmountable odds."
"You are convinced that my narrative will be a failure?"
"No, I am convinced that it has already met that condition."
I shrugged good-naturedly. "The men seem to like it." She looked to the deck and the layers of ship beneath.
"Ah, yes, the illiterate and unschooled. Perhaps you have indeed found your natural audience."
"If it really isn't to your taste, Countess, then perhaps the kindest thing would be to direct your energies elsewhere."
"That I would gladly do, Doctor. But in the absence of ancient writings, half-forgotten alphabets, cryptic codes and symbols, there is a distinct lack of occupation for a mind such as mine. These long days at sea tax the spirit dreadfully. I have read every book that came with me, and every other book that I can find aboard. I have even listened to your efforts in the direction of a novel."
"How kind. Was it perhaps a mistake to join the expedition in the first place, if your intellectual gifts are so rarefied?"
"Time will tell,"
she answered, treating my question as if it had been sincere.
"Perhaps in the edifice, Master Topolsky will find the lexical puzzles I have been put aboard to unravel. In the meantime, I must confess that I have been retained at quite a generous rate, so at least I shall not return destitute, whatever the consequences of our endeavour. You have been retained under similarly favourable terms?"
"I wouldn't know. I was hired at the standard pay for an assistant surgeon, and since I expected to learn from the experience, I saw no reason to question my salary."
"An assistant surgeon? Then there is another to whom you answer?"
"No. A ship of this rating would normally muster only an assistant surgeon." usually no better than a butcher or carpenter, with about as much concern for hygiene.
Then we must be very glad of your employment, since you are clearly a cut above those occupations. The neurosurgery you performed on Ramos was not without merit.
Thank you. I frowned at the unfamiliar term. Neurosurgery. Is that how they speak of such interventions in London?
It is how they may come to do so.
You are an exceedingly odd travelling companion, Countess. I smiled stiffly. Quite the oddest I have ever met, I feel sure. But I suppose it is better to be in the company of interesting souls, however challenging their manner.
You find me interesting?
I find you fascinating. The word nearly stuck on the tip of my tongue, but it had slipped loose before I could reconsider it. By which I mean as infuriating as any puzzle. And yet, I have never met another individual who seemed to have taken so automatic a dislike to my entire being.
I find your book disagreeable, Doctor. I have no fixed convictions about you.
Yet you seem to find endless disappointment in my every action, my every utterance.
I see what you can be, but have not yet become. What you might be with the right direction, the right instruction, the right training.
She nodded peremptorily between these statements.
Perhaps instead of seeing me as your adversary, you should see me as one who wishes to shape and encourage your development.
I have asked for no such shaping.
You have need of it nonetheless.
She plucked a feather from her hat and tickled her cheek with the end of it. An absurd vision flashed into mind. Countess Cossille leaning over me, chewing on the end of her feather, while I lay pressed to the deck of Demeter by some immense, crushing mass of wood, my innards destroyed. She studied me with sudden concern.
Are you all right, Doctor? You have quite lost your colour.
It's nothing. This seasickness dogs me, even in these calmer waters. Some ghost of sympathy haunted her features.
This is hard for both of us. But if you insist on thinking of Demeter as a ship of the sea, seasickness will be a part of it. Can you not make the adjustment at last? It will be so much easier when you do.
What adjustment?
That which you resist. That which will bring you to a full understanding of our predicament.
I do not know what remains to be understood. Our predicament seems plain enough. We're aboard a ship, navigating the islands and inlets of Patagonia, under hire to a private expedition.
There is vastly more, Doctor. But the difficulty is this. As soon as you catch a glimpse of the larger truth, you are apt to push it away, as you will doubtless push me away any instant now on some pretext conjured up by your...
Code! Barked Topolsky. The sighting is upon us, men. Not a second more of your dilly-dallying. I want our entire party captured in the moment of my... our triumph. You too, Ada.
I am sorry, Countess, I said hurriedly, realizing, with a sting of envy, that it was the first time I had heard her forename, and that it distressed me that Topolsky could utter it so carelessly, while I would have given the world to hear it tumble from her lips. Let us continue our discussion, our very curious discussion, at some other opportunity. She shook her head. Disappointment, exasperation, some yet deeper flavour of despair I could not yet categorise. We assembled into a formal group on deck. Captain von Foot and Master Topolsky to the fore, the latter would insist on nothing less, and then the members of the expeditionary party on the second row, Dupin, Herr Brucker, Countess Cossille, and Coronel Ramos. I had been hired on at the same time as the rest of the party, but I was not to be considered part of it, and so I joined Murgatroyd and the other senior officers in the third rank. And then Mortlock and an assortment of respected midshipmen lined up to form the fourth, merely to make up the numbers. I wondered who Topolsky was going to delegate to work the camera, but that consideration was already taken care of. Brucker had equipped the camera with an ingenious clockwork mechanism which opened and closed the shutter automatically. "They are clever in Stuttgart, ja?" asked Brucker, leaning in so that I felt his breath upon my neck.
"You men in England scurry about like mice, but we have clockwork to do our bidding."
I twisted around to address the odd, owlish man, his curious brush of black hair fully exposed now that he had his hat in his hands.
"I am sure the men of Stuttgart are to be congratulated on their industriousness," I replied. "But do we really want a world run by clockwork?" Distractions of foreign innovations aside, the business was fully as tedious as expected. I had been photographed before. Such advancements had even reached the West Country. But it was one thing to remain quite still and expressionless on land. On a deck, even a deck moving as gently as ours did, the body resisted such stillness. It was difficult to keep our balance while remaining motionless, and soon the movement of the shore began to make me feel reliably nauseous, over and above such lingering seasickness as never quite left me. Topolsky insisted on exposing 6 plates to add to the ordeal. The strain of remaining perfectly still proved too much for Dupin, who fainted suddenly, collapsing down onto the shoulders of Captain von Voot, who caught the boy before he came to any further harm. Dupin, in a daze, made his stumbling way to a crate, where he sat down in a funk of pale dizziness. "You must take better care of yourself," I told him, pinching back his eyelids while he remained seated. "You have worked yourself to the brink of exhaustion, Raymond. You also have a fever."
"The chart was always in my room."
"I don't doubt it. As the captain kindly explained, I saw a different chart. Does that satisfy you?"
"I think I'm nearly there,"
he said, in a low, somnambulant sort of voice. "Nearly where?" Dupin rummaged in his coat pocket and produced a soggy-looking mass of crumpled paper, blue with ink.
"I'm nearly there. I can nearly see it."
He pressed his fingertips against the mass of paper, making it spring open along certain folds and hinge tighter on others.
"It's just a folded piece of paper. I haven't cut it or anything."
"You need to rest."
"You can't see it, but it's possible. It's a sphere, you see."
He pinched the paper between 2 extremities, making it balloon out like a soggy attempt at a paper lantern.
"It's a sphere. I think it was always a sphere, and then something went wrong. That's the topology."
I looked to the land speeding by us on either side of Demeter. "Topography?"
"No. Topology. Surfaces and volumes. Transformations. Homotopic transformations. Can you see it, Doctor?"
"See what?" I asked, gently.
"How to make it inside out. There's a way. I can nearly see it."
I could see that he was profoundly troubled, consumed by a fever of speculation, as real, perhaps, as the fever of the blood which warmed his brow. "I don't think you need to waste your time on that. You can't turn a sphere inside out." He looked at me with a sudden, brittle shock, as if I had just told him that his favourite puppy had been shot.
"No."
Topolsky ambled over with something glassy in his hand. I had no time to react before he spirited it into position beneath Dupin's nose. Dupin sneezed violently and nearly crashed onto his back off the crate. I grabbed the boy by the scruff of his neck with one hand and seized Topolsky's little vial with another. Rage nearly made me crush it. I only had to waft it within a foot of my nose to detect its awful pungency, smothering even the oils Topolsky worked into his beard and hair. He's my patient, you Cossack bastard, I said.
And he's my employee, Topolsky said, as are you, Code.
He glared at me, retrieved his vial, then glanced down at something on the deck. It was Dupin's paper construction, fallen from his fingers as the sneezing fit hit him. Some trick of the impact had caused its paper hinges to react in a quite specific way, making the object snap from one soggy state to another. Now it had become quite an odd shape, less like a sphere or lantern, and more like a cross between a marine screw, like the one that propelled Demeter, and a twisted, stubby-limbed octopus. Or, perhaps, a fat-limbed spider. Topolsky jammed his foot onto the object, reducing it to a pulp of blue-stained papier-mâché.
Cossack bastard or not, he said quietly, I still own this expedition.
Dupin was still pinching his nose and sneezing, his reddened eyes streaming tears. Demeter continued around the headland. Minutes passed, with barely any human voices to disturb the muffled chug of the marine engine beneath the decks. All eyes were on that extending shoreline. There was no beach as such, merely a drab margin of broken, ice-speckled stone between the water and the start of the hillside. Surely we were already far enough around the headland that we ought to have seen something. And then, quite suddenly, it was there. There had been no warning, no hint of outlying works or ground disturbance. Emerging into view around the lowest part of the headland was an abrupt, soaring grey wall of such perfect smoothness and regularity that I immediately banished any thoughts that I might be seeing a natural feature. Another wall interposed itself, set at an angle to the first, and then a third. Slowly, I realized that we were seeing a series of projecting ramparts of varying heights and widths, laid out on curling paths, like the coiled arms of a thick, muscular octopus. From our low vantage, it was all but impossible to construct a coherent impression of how these features were arranged and connected. There were many of them, some ending in turrets, some seeming to curve back into the main mass of stone. I was, however, struck by a singular impression, that if an ordered, rectilinear, geometrically sensible fortification were graven onto some medium such as thick, foamy coffee, and the liquid then stirred, stretching and distorting along axes of rotation, the resultant form might begin to resemble the spectacle we saw before us. More of it came into view as we progressed, extending both vertically and horizontally. The walls lifted higher and higher the further back they were, resembling terraces cut into a sheer hillside. I had no reliable sense of distance, and nothing else in the scene that offered anything by which I might gauge the wall's height. Not a man, tree or house, however imperfect such yardsticks might have been. But my skin-prickling intuition was certain enough of one thing. The innermost walls were too tall.
An estimate of height, please, Dupin, Topolsky said.
Dupin, his eyes still watering, and still, it seemed to me, only a flutter away from fainting once more, had resumed his role as cartographer and surveyor. Instead of binocular telescopes, he now made use of an even more intricate device, assembled from engraved quadrants, fine balances, and jewel-like lenses.
750,
he reported. But this was not a verdict on the height of the innermost walls, merely an interim report.
800,
he called again. Then,
850.
We have the upper limit,
Topolsky said excitedly. The succession of walls had finally stopped climbing. Now we were viewing horizontal battlements laid out on the top of the walls. They rose and fell in sickly, sinuous waves, like sore-backed reptiles stretched out on undulating ground.
880 feet, Dupin reported.
My mind reeled at the notion of the masons who had labored to throw those immense walls up into the air. I could, at the limit of my vision, begin to discern wavering lines of regular blocks, hundreds upon hundreds of them. They ought to have reminded me of brickwork, but instead they brought scales to mind. Perhaps it was the movement of the intervening air over the cold water of the lagoon, but the walls seemed to breathe in and out as my eye swept across them. Nor were the walls the end of it. Projecting above the sinuous battlements was a stone-built citadel, the prize, surely, that these monstrous defences sought to enclose. Like the walls, it thrust back in a succession of layers, each higher than the last. There were gatehouses, keeps, linking walls, many such walls rising in dizzying stepped tiers, and more towers than I could easily count, jostling together like the sky-blackening chimneys of some dream of industry. Up and up the great towers soared, lessening in number with progressive height until a dozen or fewer, the mightiest peaks of the range, stood sentinel. The topmost part of one of these towers, surmounted by a stone finial, must have been the object we discerned above the headland. Our slow progress disclosed the full extent of the structure. It ended as it had begun, without any sign of surrounding formations or encampments. The quarter-mile succession of walls terminated abruptly, with just a rocky margin of shore and mud-coloured slopes beyond it. The edifice stood alone, without context, without explanation. Topolsky was in a sort of stupor. Dupin, with more presence of mind, was executing a quick, methodical sketch, his fingers still blue-stained from his paper construction. We had the photographic equipment, of course, but from the moving deck the image could never be entirely sharp, and I think Dupin wished to commit something to paper, while there was a chance.
"Well," von Voot asked, "is it all that you hoped for, Master?"
Topolsky tried speaking and came out hoarse with excitement. He had to thump his own windpipe before he could proceed.
"What I hoped for, dear Captain. I stand before you struck mute with wonder and astonishment. There was a part of me that doubted, even until that first glimpse, that it could be real. Yet here I stand, silent, upon a peak in Darien."
"Not entirely silent," von Voot answered.
"There is something wrong with it," I said.
"Of course there is something wrong with it, you imbecile," Topolsky said, nearly laughing at my evident stupidity. "Its very manifestation is a wrongness. The edifice should not be here. Its presence is an affront to order and sense."
"I mean that it does not look quite right. There is something..." I faltered, searching for the words that would not condemn me as a fool. "Something askew. Do you not see it? It is like a thing seen in a mirage, twisting and rippling in the air, yet frozen in one particular aspect of its changing. Those curving, coiling battlements make me seasick."
"You are never not seasick, Code."
"It is more than that. Those towers lean in or away from each other to a small but troubling degree, like skittles about to topple."
"Your eyes may serve you for the humble examining rooms of Plymouth, but I am afraid they deceive you where distance is concerned."
Under his breath, but audibly, he added,
"These bastards' eyes are not so afflicted."
"I see the wrongness just as clearly," von Voot said.
"Then it is a trick of the eye brought about by the motion of Demeter," Topolsky said.
"It is not the first time I have sighted something on land," von Voot replied. "Would you care to comment, Monsieur Dupin?"
Dupin continued his sketching without interruption. I'd always quite liked watching another man make marks on paper, but Dupin's strokes were more like impressions laid down by an engraving machine. Faultless and precise, but in their very exactitude deadening to the eye. I noticed, in amongst his drawings of the scenery about us, and the object itself,
sketches which seemed to convey steps in the deformation of his paper construction, now ruined. It was as if, despite the thing before him, his mind could not resist returning to its prior occupation.
There is a deviation from the expected regularity along a number of axes, he said. When we have closed in, I shall be able to quantify the degrees of this deviation and its probable causes.
I nodded slowly, glad that my observation had been confirmed. I suppose there may have been subsidence in the walls, or whatever foundation those towers emerge from. But it can't have been very serious, or we'd see rubble all around the base where other towers have already collapsed.
Let us not venture into supposition when the facts alone will guide us, Topolsky declared. The new science of photography will resolve all ambiguity. Set aside your obsolete sketching, Dupin. Such rude handiwork belongs on cave walls, not in our learned institutions. Thanks to the good offices of Monsieur Daguerre, we have no further need of such daubings.
The photographic equipment was made ready again. The clockwork timer wound, and we were encouraged to take up formal poses behind the captain and the master, while that monstrous mass of stone rose behind us like an architect's fever dream. Dupin's fingers kept jerking. There was nothing between them now, not even a pencil, but I fancied he still imagined himself holding that ball of folded paper. What had he seen in his mind's eye, I wondered? What had troubled him so? What was still troubling him? Chapter 8. In the evening, with the ship's mood caught uneasily between cheer that we had weathered the inlet and faint foreboding that we might yet sail closer to those staggering, mirage-buckled walls, the captain convened his usual companions for dining and sherry. There was, to begin with, really only one conceivable topic of conversation, and I was perfectly content to lean back and observe it as a nearly mute witness, except when I was prodded for an opinion. The plates had come back, with Monsieur Dupin's drawings, which were as fastidious and neat as architectural prints, spread between them. And I watched as Murgatroyd, Topolsky, Dupin and Brooker ran rulers and protractors across them, comparing dimensions and angles and trading supposition and inference concerning the relative sizes of features in the edifice. Ramos, who said as little as anyone, watched this discourse with an unlit cigar pinched between his lips.
Logic dictates that there will be a point of entry presumably concealed within the complexities of those walls, Topolsky said, riffling excitedly between the papers and plates. Doubtless, since those walls are clearly defensive in function, any opening must be enclosed within them, invisible from our present vantage. If there is not a gatehouse, there will be a concealed door, tunnel, or perhaps a set of stairs cut into the wall, or even a bridge feeding in from the uplands beyond.
You count on a way in? Von Voot asked.
There must be one.
Not if it's a tomb sealed up after construction,
pointed out Countess Cossille. Or a prison of the sort where inmates were tossed over the walls and left to rot within. She eyed me coquettishly as if we shared a private joke, or perhaps the same private nightmare.
Perhaps when you breach those walls, you will be overwhelmed by a tidal wave of skeletons.
There are window slits in the walls and crenellations along the tops of them, Murgatroyd said, tapping a finger against a fuzzy detail in one of the plates. To me they speak of defense. Whichever forgotten Norse warlord made this thing, they meant to keep it for themselves.
He nodded at Topolsky.
I think we will find a way in. No matter how well built a fortress, even if it had its own water supply and perhaps room enough inside those walls for sheep pastures and orchards, there would still have been a need for supplies.
If there isn't a door, Ramos said, one can be arranged, provided the blasting powder is of sufficient potency.
Cossille reached over and tapped Ramos on the wrist, not without some chilly affection.
Dear Coronel, You really will not rest until you have blown something up, will you?
One way or another, there will be a way in, Topolsky said. And if we must depend on Mr. Ramos's munitions, Ada, then we shall. In a little while, the fog of distance will lift, and we shall gaze on our adversary with sharpened eyes and sharpened wits.
I could not resist an interjection. Our adversary, other than standing there a little ominously, it hasn't done us any harm, is it?
I speak figuratively, Code. It is our adversary in that it represents ignorance and the unknown. And as men and women of science, we may agree that such deficiencies in our understanding will likely be rectified with no small measure of struggle and setback. Be it the work of nature or the work of man, secrets and mysteries are never willingly divulged.
He finished one cigar and lit another.
If they were, wherein would lie the glory, the nobility of scientific conquest?
He leaned in confidingly, looking up and down the table.
The edifice will exact a toll from us, friends, of that I am certain. But we shall best it, and such scars as it inflicts on us, scars of body and soul, shall be all the more proudly worn, for we alone shall know the cost of them. Gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here.
Or extremely glad to have had a lion, Cossiel murmured.
I smiled. She caught my eye and smiled back. Murgatroyd picked up one of the plates and held it closer to his own singular eye, examining something near the base of the edifice. A little dark smudge pressed between the shoreline and the first flank of stone.
What is that, gentlemen? I don't recall seeing it when we were on deck.
Your flaw in the plate, Topolsky dismissed.
It is not a flaw, Brooker said. It is real. The same thing is shown on this plate.
It is distinct from the edifice, Dupin commented. 80 feet long, I would estimate, and perhaps 50 or 60 in height.
May I? Asked the captain politely.
He took the first plate from Murgatroyd and studied it carefully. Then he set it down slowly.
I think it is a wreck, gentlemen. The masts are discernible and perhaps a funnel. The main part is the hull. It is a steamship like the Meter. I do not think any other sort of ship could have navigated the fissure.
How old could it be? I asked, willing to expose my ignorance of maritime propulsion.
We will know when we are a little closer. Certainly not more than 30 years. I think she may be a paddle steamer rather than screw-driven.
He turned his face to Topolsky.
Did the men of Europa know of this wreck, Master? If so, it is curious that you have made no mention of it until now.
Their intelligence mentioned no wreck, Topolsky said dismissively. And it need be of no concern to us. Ill-equipped ships come to grief all the while. We are anything but ill-equipped.
Still, we will approach that shore with caution,
Van Voort ruminated between sips of sherry.
We shall anchor just off the headland, and then send out the boats the rest of the way. They will have a little further to row, but the men will not mind the exercise if there is a promise of dry land and extra grog at the end of it.
He nodded at Murgatroyd.
Perhaps you will even find a patch of ground level enough for cricket, Lieutenant. I know you miss your strange English game. In the meantime, if there are useful stores in that wreck, we will make them ours.
And bodies? I asked, tentatively. Van Voort nodded somberly.
I hope there are none, Silas, but if there are, we shall treat them with the respect due to all brothers of the sea.
I picked up one of the plates that had been taken of the formal group, with the edifice behind us. The plate had been chemically fixed, so it could be exposed to light, but it had not yet been duplicated as a photographic negative. As a consequence, all that was light was dark, and all that was dark was light. Demeter was a spectre of itself, its gunwales pale as bone, floating on a milky sea beneath an ashen sky. I turned the plate upside down, so that the ship seemed suspended from a ceiling of ice, with an immensity of sucking darkness clawing at it from below.
"Do you notice, Doctor, that the crew haven't registered at all?"
Countess Cassil inquired.
"They were scurrying around like rats while the rest of us stood still enough to be captured. Other than the occasional phantom, where some man lingered long enough to leave a trace of himself, it is as if we haunt a ghost ship, as if we ourselves are already dead."
"You have a morbid streak, Countess," said Murgatroyd, smiling awkwardly.
"It is a failing," she agreed.
"The image is inverted," I said, turning the frame the right way around.
"Everted. No, inverted. May I ask, Countess, what is meant by eversion?"
She frowned in my direction.
"Is there such a word, Doctor?"
"There is,"
Dupin interjected excitedly, a fusillade of spit bursting between his teeth.
"But its usage is rather specialized. Among mathematicians, it refers to the act of being turned inside out."
Brooker scraped a hand along the ribbon of black hair which divided his cranium.
"As the starfish everts its stomach, yeah?"
"In mathematical framing, the definition is rather more rigorous," Dupin said. "But you have the crude sense of it. As a matter of fact, the problem is of interest to me. Consider the question of sphere eversion in a three-dimensional space."
"Enough, boy," Topolsky said. "Some of us will be averting our own stomachs rather than listen to you babble on about spheres and spaces."
His tone turned patrician.
"Concentrate on the here and now, as you are paid to do, rather than this airy-fairy nonsense."
"I do not think it is nonsense to Dupin," I said, struck by a protective urge towards the boy, for all his peculiar single-mindedness. "In fact, I should like to hear more about it. I am afraid my own mathematical education progressed no further than Napier's bones."
"How many bones did he have, sir?"
asked Mortlock.
206, just like everyone else," Countess Cossiel said. Then, to me, "Do you really mean to rectify your ignorance of matters mathematical, Doctor? If so, I imagine it will only be a matter of time before the shadow of Pythagoras falls across your literary imagination."
She clapped delightedly.
"Spare us the torment, Doctor. What is next for our gratification?"
"I am spent," I said, pressing back into my seat. "You have all been kind, and I fear the time for fiction is at an end." I held up one of the photographic plates. "Nothing that I might imagine can begin to compare with that. Besides, I sense I may already have strained the patience of my friends."
"Oh dear,"
the Countess said, pursing her lips in a mock pout.
"Have my little observations really been so wounding?"
"It has nothing to do with your observations, Countess, wounding or otherwise."
"Why then, I must implore you to continue."
She looked around the table for support.
"The doctor is entirely too self-effacing about his efforts. I am sure I am not alone in finding that his narrative gave me much to think about."
"Much to pick holes in, you mean?" said Mortlock spiritedly. "Midshipman,"
Van Voot rumbled, warning him not to overstep his welcome in such elevated company.
"I still do not understand what is meant by a submarine,"
Brooker lamented.
"A ship that moves beneath the waves," I said.
"A ship of metal, no doubt," Countess Cossiel said.
Beyond our lagoon, somewhere in the warren of channels and inlets to the west, a distant storm discharged its fury. There was no thunder, but a single pulse of lightning limned the cabin windows, etching them in a tracery of blue light. "There is always lightning," I mouthed to myself. Ramos sat quietly in my cabin. Often when the dinner guests had dispersed from the captain's table, the coronel and I shared a small cigar or a little snifter of brandy between us, each of us content not to speak for the sake of speaking, but to enjoy our silences as deeply as our conversations. Sometimes Ramos brought a little guitar. It was made of an almost impossibly delicate and translucent wood, so that one could nearly see through it.
and played Spanish and Mexican folk tunes he had been taught in his childhood. His fingers were clumsy on the frets and strings to start with, but after a few tries he invariably settled into the task, gaining in confidence and fluency as he went. We spoke now and then of poetry and music, sometimes of our childhoods, though I more readily than he, and then occasionally of our intentions for the future, beyond our days on Demeter. "I have fallen foul of Topolsky," I said, pouring a little more brandy into the other man's snifter.
"Easily done.
But perhaps not so enthusiastically as was witnessed today. First I called him a Cossack bastard." A mild shrug.
"He's both of those things."
"But it is not gentlemanly to make such an observation."
What was the provocation?"
"I was tending to Dupin after that fainting spell. I was concerned for the boy. He needed rest. Topolsky sauntered over and..." I waved aside my own recollection. "No matter. No provocation excused my words. Dupin was my patient, but..."
"You say first. And the second thing?"
"Well, perhaps the more serious insult. I spoiled his moment of triumph when the object came into view. It was his to enjoy, by any measure, yet I had the reckless temerity to point out that there was something imperfect in his edifice." He rolled the snifter in his fingers, dipping his nose to the rim.
"Again, you only spoke the truth. He's a bastard, and that object is crooked."
"But it might not have been so unwise of me to hold my tongue. It is a failing of mine, as it is a failing of Dupin's and indeed the Countess," I sighed, "although we do it for different reasons. I am moved to rage when a man gets between me and my duty of care. Dupin is an innocent who has no choice but to say what is in his mind. There is no malice in him, just that awkward compulsion." Ramos said, nodding faintly.
"I agree. Countess Cosille."
"Of the three of us, I think she is the only one who enjoys wounding. She is infuriating. And yet..."
"And yet..."
He beckoned, smiling at my candor. "She beguiles me." I grunted, irritated at myself for speaking so freely. "She is also not the problem. I offend her by existing. With Master Topolsky, although I ranked low in his estimation, I did at least hope that there might be scope for improving my standing."
"Perhaps it is not his estimation that matters."
I looked at him guardedly. "You think not?"
"I knew such men when I served under Santa Anna. At first, they command your attention because of their noise and grandiosity. They are always the loudest men in any room. And it is understandable that we should want their favor, as the flower seeks the favor of the sun."
He shifted, equally uncomfortable with such freedom of expression.
"But during our assault on the Alamo, I learned that the worth of a man is not to be found in the strength of his voice or even his convictions. Convictions are, what is your saying, to a penny?"
He made a dismissive, swatting gesture.
"They die like flies. No, Silas. I saw the best and the worst of men at a battle. Men on both sides of our little dispute. And I saw the humblest of them become lions, and the proudest of them reduced to praying lambs."
"Must you respect a man to be in his service?"
"No," he answered carefully. "But since it helps to be paid, you must respect the fullness of his pockets. In that regard, our boastful friend may be relied upon. I have already sent funds back to Mexico, and more will follow when we finish our expedition."
"Is your family safe now?"
"As safe as ever."
My question seemed to cause him some amiable puzzlement.
"It is kind of you to ask, but did I mention a concern?"
"I thought that there was some difficulty, a religious or political matter."
"In Mexico, we are inclined to make little distinction."
The huge man shrugged,
lantern light burnishing the dented gleam of his skull.
No, my grandfather's made the right choice in siding with Miguel Hidalgo over the King of Spain. The enemies they made are safely in the ground now. Their ghosts grow weaker each year, and our country is unshackled.
Well, I am glad of it, and I'm sorry if it seemed as if I was prying into your private affairs.
When one man has looked into the head of another, Silas, there need be no secrets between them.
He took another sip, and it seemed to loosen something in him.
I shall tell you something more of Master Topolsky, although it must remain between us. I think it will help you understand him better, and perhaps forgive him some of his failings.
He gathered himself.
When I was first in his service, before I met you, he spoke to me of an episode of illness in his childhood.
I smiled wryly. The master seems too indomitable to succumb to any known malady.
He puffs himself up, runs around a lot, and makes an impressive noise. But that is also true of the plump, stupid birds that you English like to shoot for sport. Beneath the feathers, there is often less than meets the eye.
His own observation seeming to trouble him, Ramos gave a shake of head, one part negation and another shame.
Still, I would not work for a man I considered completely without honor. He is a bastard, but then so am I. He is brave, has never lied to me, and I do not believe he will lead us astray. We each of us have our armor.
And what of his illness?
A fever, confined to bed, adrift from all sense of time and place, with nothing to occupy his senses but the fluttering of bedroom curtains. This was in the long, wild summer nights of his homeland, already a strain on anyone's soundness of mind. Once, in the endless warm evening, he fancied that the curtains flew apart by an impossible degree, such that the view between them was the entirety of his universe.
A note of awe entered Ramos's retelling.
And he saw it, Silas, as the curtains parted, so for him did the thin veil of reality. Beyond it stood a glittering clockwork of such complexity and perfection as to make our friend Brooker weep. That sight of it did not last long. But by the way he spoke of this episode, I believe it has cast a shadow of desperate longing across his entire life.
I thought of the times I'd been abed with illness in Plymouth, an unwilling prisoner of my own reeling imagination. Surely the wiser part of him knew it to be a consequence of fever?
Indeed, but our wiser parts are not our masters.
Would that they were, I reflected. But you are right, of course. And I see now that he must have been hoping to see a facet of that perfection in the edifice. Perhaps for a second he did. But then I undid the spell by pointing out the wrongness of what we saw before us.
You broke the spell, but if you had not done it, Ramon Dupin would have said something, and if not Dupin, then Henry Murgatroyd or even our captain.
When one is being stabbed, I'm not sure it matters that there might be other daggers waiting in the wings. I bowed my head in regret. Still, if there is one salvation, his opinion of me was low enough to begin with. There is scarcely room for it to go any lower.
As I said, you are not to be blamed. A doctor ran off with his mother. Ever since then, he has held your entire profession accountable and contemptible.
Regardless of their opinions, most men eventually have use of us.
Indeed. And he is not so foolish as to think we could weather these seas without a physician, and that was before this.
He rapped a knuckle near the spot where I had opened him.
And I mention his illness, which he only confessed to me in a blaze of drunkenness, only that you should better understand the man we follow. He speaks of fame and fortune, but what he truly seeks is one instant back in that fever bed, where the curtains flung wide and all heaven spread before him like a banquet.
He will never have it.
No, Ramos agreed. But be sure it is Silas. He will not be denied in his search. And a man like that is to be feared as much as he is admired. That bastard will lead us to one of two things. Glory or ruin.
I topped up his glass and mine as well. It is a strange thing, Coronel, that your misfortune has been the cause of a friendship. I ought to regret any injury that befalls a man, especially one as serious as yours. But I fear I am not as sorry as I should be. Ramos touched my glass with his.
Nor I that it happened to dear Silas.
Chapter 9. Demeter anchored in the middle of the lagoon, about a mile further east than the headland, and lowered two boats into the water. With the captain's encouragement, and since none of the men needed my attention come morning, I clambered awkwardly down the ropes, my equipment lowered in advance, to board the pinnace, the larger of the expeditionary vessels. Both the pinnace and the smaller jolly boat were sturdy, white-painted craft. The pinnace took 10 men, the jolly boat 6, together with ample supplies to outfit a camp for several days. The pinnace was the only one with a mast, but it was not used today. Each boat carried rowers made up of midshipmen, 6 in the heavier pinnace, 2 in the jolly boat. Mortlock was the only one I knew by name, and he was already in the pinnace, fussing with a bandage around his palm. Ramos came aboard as well, since this boat carried the bulk of the powder barrels and fuses that were his responsibility. The remainder of our non-rowing party was made up of Murgatroyd and Dupin, at least to begin with. But then there was some discussion among Demeter's hands about the relative weights of various belongings, and it was deemed that Dupin's surveying materials had to be put into the other boat for the sake of balance. Since Dupin would not travel without them, even if they remained in plain sight for the entire crossing, and no man was likely to be so idiotic as to tamper with them, it was arranged for Dupin to climb over into the other boat, and Countess Cossille to take his place in the pinnace. "Well, Doctor," the Countess said, facing me as she positioned herself on one of the cross-planks, "it seems that Monsieur Dupin cannot bear the thought of us being separated." I doubt that Dupin had a thought in his head save for the jealous protection of his instruments. He is like a schoolboy guarding his homework from the other boys.
"It is true that he has found his one vocation, and will not countenance another trespassing into his expertise."
"I doubt that any of us has the slightest interest in doing so."
"Ah, but you were the only one of us who asked about that word, clearly cutting to the heart of his interests. What is a cartographer but a very specialized kind of mathematician?"
"I had inversion in mind, and eversion slipped out," I said testily. "No more needs to be made of it."
"Oh, dear."
"Oh, dear what?"
"I shall have to break it to Monsieur Dupin that the doctor is in a very disagreeable mood."
I said nothing. If my eyes lingered on the line of her jaw for a second longer than prudence dictated, then I hoped that the error was beneath the threshold of her observation. And yet, she beguiles me. Murgatroyd nodded to the men to begin rowing, and with strong regular strokes, the pinnace and the jolly boat began to slip away from Demeter. Across the cold water, the grunts and murmurs of the men in the other boat reached us as if we travelled hull to hull. Topolsky was quiet, I noticed, not his usual rambunctious self. He sat small and slope-shouldered, like a dark, slumping sack of coal, his back to the direction of travel. Something in the imperfection of the edifice had roused troubling ideas within him. He brooded rather than boasted, and when he spoke, to Dupin, Brooker, or across the water to one of our number, he made a noticeable effort to avert his eyes from the very thing that drew us.
"How is your wound, Coronel Ramos?" the Countess asked brightly, looking over my shoulder.
"I do not think it will be the thing that kills me this time."
"This time?"
"I am sorry."
"You do not think it will be the thing that kills you this time? What a peculiar formulation. Is that a thing that men say to each other in Mexico? Perhaps when the old religions still grip the imagination, it is not so unusual to speak of cycles of death and rebirth.
It was nothing, I assure you.
She redirected her attention to me.
Do you think it odd, Dr. Code, to speak in such terms?
We are not all linguists, Countess. The Coronel was merely making friendly conversation in a language that is not his mother tongue. Would it not be a kindness to let the occasional error go unnoticed, or is that entirely beneath your capabilities?
You really have roused yourself with the wrong head on.
She dipped her head to my boxes of medical equipment, tucked low in the boat and protected from damage by masses of rope and canvas.
I hope you brought everything with you, or your mood will be even more intolerable by evening.
We progressed. The lagoon's banks were far enough away that I perceived no impression of movement, but after several minutes, a backward glance showed the distance we had attained from the ship. Against a rising backdrop of rock and ice, Demeter looked dainty, toy-like and fragile. How could such a little thing swallow 100 men like a whale and still feel empty and haunted in the quiet watches? Slowly our course altered the angle between boat and ship, such that Demeter seemed to slowly revolve as if on a potter's wheel.
They have repaired that mast very well, I commented to Murgatroyd, anxious to establish a line of conversation that did not involve the Countess.
De mast, Doctor, Murgatroyd asked pleasantly.
I frowned at him.
The one that broke, Henry, during our passage. I am quite sure I remember it crashing to the deck.
Murgatroyd gained the wary, tactful look of someone who is going to have to set another man right without causing insult.
Oh, there was a bit of damage here and there, you're quite right, but nothing as serious as a mast coming down. That's a very bad thing indeed. I'm sure there was a lot of noise and shouting, even so, and if you're below decks, that can sound a lot worse than it is.
I was about to answer that I remembered it vividly because I had been on deck at the time of the mishap. But some rare caution stilled my tongue.
Thank you, Henry. Time and again I realize I should never venture to have an opinion on anything to do with the fabric of the ship, because I'm quite sure to make a fool of myself.
You stick to bones, Doctor, and we'll stick to sails and coal, Murgatroyd told me amiably. And it's not foolishness, is it, Mr. Mortlock?
Not at all,
Mortlock said, agreeing hastily with his superior officer.
A ship's like a whole new world. You could be born on a ship and you'd still go to your grave learning something new. I'll tell you what I learned last night. There's 206 bones in a body. Imagine being dead and all those bones rattling around inside you. I don't think I fancy being dead.
A tunnel, a stone passage, a suit of armour. My own reflection disclosing a skull. Being dead is bad enough, I thought. But there is something worse. Walking around with someone else's bones inside you.
We're back to mortality again, are we, gentlemen?
Asked the Countess, as if she were privy to my very thoughts. Absently, she plucked a feather from her hat and tossed it overboard, where the weak currents of the lagoon soon bore it away, a lonely little yellow messenger off on its own. The boats crunched against the loose scree that bordered the lagoon shallows. We disembarked, wading through 2 feet of shivering cold water until finding ourselves on dry, if slippery and ankle-twisting, land. Ahead of us stood the flank of the nearest wall, a mere prelude to the rising, undulating defences beyond, and between us and the wall lay the wreck we had spied from Demeter. It was indeed another steamship, but, as the captain had ventured, a paddle-wheeled vessel. We were looking at its starboard side with the port side pressed close to the wall. The wreck was well above the shoreline, 50 or 60 feet beyond the present limit of the water, and a good 10 feet of elevation above it, resting on a bank of large round pebbles and still larger irregular boulders, some of which had pierced the hull such that her planks had been split, forced apart, and in some places cleaved clean away.
Through the gaps where planks had split or were gone, we made out the dark, musty promise of her holds, and whatever useful goods might yet lie within them. Halfway along the hull was the starboard paddle wheel, or rather its greatly mangled remains. The wheel's semicircular housing was nearly intact, but the main part of the wheel was a ruin of broken spokes and shattered paddles. Perhaps the weather had caused it to rot and collapse in gradual fashion, but I wondered instead if the wheel had still been turning, still revolving under the full force of steam, when the ship found itself tossed onto the rocks, the wheel shattering itself in a whirling orgy of self-destruction. Like Demeter, she had carried masts and sails, but little now remained of these, save three grisly stumps surmounted by sagging, broken crossbeams, draped with the skin-like remains of canvas. They made me think of three crude crosses raised above some ghastly cavalry, whose storm-wracked sky was the grey rampart beyond. Of her name, no trace was to be seen, had it ever been inscribed on her hull. We did not go near the wreck to begin with. Ramos, Murgatroyd, and Mortlock selected an area of relatively level ground where the rocks were small enough to be trod underfoot, and this was where we erected our camp. Canvases were laid across the stones, tents and awnings set up, latrines dug, and tables and chairs arranged for our temporary convenience. By the standards of comfort on land, it was Spartan, but for most of us, it was an immeasurable improvement to life on Demeter. The men did not need to sleep cheek by jowl. Ablutions could be performed with some measure of privacy. There was room to wander around freely. There was a breeze. Games of cricket and football could be staged. The ground did not rise and fall or tilt with every breath. A cup of coffee could be set down on a table and trusted not to spill itself. And above all else, there was silence. Except for the men's cheerful voices and the gentle slap of the lagoon's water against the shore, a movement too feeble to be called waves. The presence of the wreck might have been expected to dampen spirits slightly, and perhaps it did, but those spirits were elevated enough that the men were still in an agreeable, playful mood, like schoolboys on the first day of liberation from their lessons. They knew in their hearts that whatever folly had befallen this earlier ship, it could not apply to the sturdier Demeter, with her modern lines and superior means of propulsion. I had a tent to myself, and that was welcome, but was also obliged to serve as my office, examining room, and even operating theatre, should anything befall the men. So far they had all made it ashore unscathed, healthy, except for the minor maladies of which I was already aware. Ramos was growing in strength from day to day, but I observed him carefully all the same. Although he had responded well to the surgery, it would likely be many months before we could be completely sure that he was out of danger. Exhaustion still dogged Dupin, but there was little I could do about that. Proximity to the object only stoked his enthusiasm for work, and we had barely touched land before he was springing around with his surveying gear like some mad naturalist with a butterfly net. The wall which loomed above the wreck was but the nearest of many, and lower than the tiered ramparts which rose beyond it. But it was still tall enough to inspire feelings of the sublime. A green margin hemmed its base to about the height of a man. It puzzled me to begin with, until I realized that it was an extension of the tidal staining which marked some of the rocks and pebbles around our tents. I glanced back with some foreboding to the lagoon, wondering if its tidal range could possibly be so high as to submerge our entire camp. Surely, though, men such as Murgatroyd, with their knowledge of almanacs and tables, would have performed the necessary estimation of risk before deciding on our temporary base. An urge overcame me, and I retreated to my tent before the visible manifestations of my addiction became too stark. Drawing the flap behind me, I busied myself arranging supplies for a minute or two, while listening for footfalls and voices outside. Once I was satisfied that no one was near, or in danger of coming near, I quickly injected myself with morphine, then lay down on my bed, listening to the racing whirl of my heart. Appalled and fascinated in the same breath, I visualized it as a paddle-like engine, spinning nearly to the point of destruction, and I wondered if the doctors of the future might yet perfect such a machine for men whose hearts were ailing. Without warning, a huge, bearded, bald-crowned face jammed itself through the loosely secured flap.
"Silas,"
Ramos said, affecting no surprise at my posture.
"I called, but you didn't answer. I would not have interrupted so rudely if I had known you were resting."
I pushed myself up on my elbows, glad that I had taken the trouble to pack away the syringe and morphine. "Just a little lightheaded. It's curious, isn't it? I've been afflicted by seasickness for almost the entirety of our voyage, and most especially since Montevideo, dreaming of nothing but the fixity of terra firma. Yet now that I am upon dry land at last, I feel myself struck by a dizziness that feels very much like a close cousin of seasickness itself."
"It means only that you are at last adapting to the meter."
"A good thing, then," I said, doubtfully, hoping that my story of dizziness was a satisfactory cover for the effects of morphine addiction and the remedy thereof. "Although it does not feel like much of a good thing while I'm in the bitter throes of it." His faint smile conveyed either sympathy or the wise understanding that I lied, but that he would not be so unkind as to remark upon it.
"Perhaps a little straw will help."
"I doubt that, but what do you have in mind?"
"Murgatroyd and I are going to investigate the wreck while the light is still with us. We will take a couple of lanterns, but it will still be dark inside. You are, of course, welcome to join us."
I thought of the man I had lately offended, the man I had called a bastard to his face. "Will Master Topolsky be joining us?"
"No, and he was very dismissive of our intentions, considering it a waste of our energies. He is with Dupin now. They are planning to go all the way around the edifice before dark, looking for a way in."
"Then I think I will join you, Ramos." I gestured vaguely at my belongings. "But please allow me a minute, if you would."
"Of course," he said,
his head backing out of my tent, like the moon vanishing between veils of cloud. I met them at the rent in the starboard side of the hull, where the planks had ripped apart to create an opening through which a man might stoop with only moderate indignity. Murgatroyd had 2 Davy lamps, and he offered me one to carry, which I did gladly, since it allowed me some illusion of usefulness. Ramos had a scimitar on his belt, I will call it such, although I am no authority on swords, and a musket in his hands, and he was the first through. Splinters of rotten wood crumbling away as his mighty shoulders and back squeezed against the timbers. He crunched down onto something, then called back from the darkness, his voice echoing hollowly from within the hold.
"Come through, Henry. Then you, Silas. It is safe enough for now."
I climbed through after Murgatroyd. The space beyond was musty, but not so dark as I had anticipated. The light of day fanned through the gaps where the planks had loosened or rotted, casting ladder-like patterns over my companions' faces. We looked striped and fearsome, warriors daubed for battle. Beneath our boots was a jumble of sound timber, rotten wood, and ankle-twisting voids which went all the way down the lowest part of the ship. In places, rocks had burst through completely. At our entrance, a faint scampering sounded beneath the boards. I thought it odd that rats had survived in such a barren place, but only until Ramos showed me the grain sacks which still slumped against the sides of the hold, intermingled with coal and other provisions. Barrels which might plausibly have contained potable water had been toppled and spilled by the violence of the wreck. That was a shame, but not a catastrophe. While it might have been reassuring to find a reserve of supplies, Demeter was still well provisioned in the essentials. While Ramos was going around the hold, Murgatroyd found a ladder which led up to a hatch in the ceiling. He called the other man over, handed me his lamp so that he had both hands free, and he and Ramos began to strain at the trapdoor. I stood forlornly, rats scampering underfoot, unable to do more than watch. The hatch was stubborn, rotted into position perhaps, but after a minute of brute effort, Ramos was able to batter it loose with the stock of his musket, already generously dented from the cracking of skulls under Santa Ana. Murgatroyd reclaimed his lamp, and we climbed out of the bottommost hold into one of the intermediate decks. Again, no portals or ceiling grills offered illumination, but the planks had eased apart enough to admit a tracery of grey light, revealing a hold or storage compartment smaller than the one beneath, perhaps for lighter goods. Crates had been tossed against each other, some upended and broken, with their straw-lined innards spilled onto the floor. Here and there, the contents of these crates gleamed in our lamplight. The equipment was at once inscrutable to me, and in the same breath, instantly familiar. I did not need to know what it did or what it was called to recognize it as being comparable to the instruments and devices brought aboard Demeter by Dupin and Brooker. They came with similar intentions to us, gentlemen, to survey. Murgatroyd lifted to his eye an object somewhat like a pocket compass.
This lot doesn't look as fancy as what we have.
You are right, Henry, but I think that only speaks to this expedition being somewhat older than our own.
Master Topolsky never mentioned another expedition, did he?
I glanced at Ramos before speaking. Well, he did, Henry. Just not in terms of that ship coming to grief.
This cannot be Europa,
Ramos said, as if by assertion alone he might make it so.
This cannot be.
What was his account of Europa to you? I asked him, treading delicately, for I did not wish to imply any act of concealment or deception on his part.
As he told it to you, Silas, and you, Henry, and your captain, that the crew of Europa caught sight of the edifice, but could get no closer. They returned home and sold their intelligence.
It's too soon to say if this is the ship, I said. But if we can find our way to her helm or bridge, I imagine we will have the answer.
If they were in this ship when it ran aground, Murgatroyd said, there are going to be bodies.
Let the bodies be my business, Henry, I reassured him. We had been moving towards a door at one end of the compartment, heading in the direction of the prow. It was of stout construction, panelled and varnished wood with a small circular window set into the upper part. As our lamp swung in our hands, and faint grey light played through the timbers, I discerned a pattern of letters written on the door. Excited, hoping that these words might confirm or negate our suspicions, I pushed ahead of Ramos and Murgatroyd. The letters floated before me, faint against the varnish. They said, Propulsion Corps. No unauthorized admittance.